Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and John O'Bacon, episode 88 for September 26th, 2009. Linus Torvalds.
This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the show with free, libre, open-source software. I am your host today, Randall Schwartz. I gave Leo the week off so that I could sit here for a very special show today, a very special show today. But first, let me introduce my co-host for this show today. Hello, John O'Bacon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Randall.
And unlike most of the time when we're doing this show, we're actually face-to-face in a hotel room that is 16 floors above. What's happening downstairs?
There's LinuxCon downstairs, and LinuxPlum has kicked off today as well. And we're in the presidential suite, obviously. Yes. Randall's completely naked. I'm kind of freaked out.
Hey, you're supposed to say that. No video this time, remember?
No video, yes. By the way, so enjoy that. We've got a great interview lined up today.
We do. This has been hours in the making. We actually didn't know that we could pull this off until a couple of days ago. But if you followed my tweets in the last couple of days as we're recording this, you saw that, in fact, I was able to get up to talk to Linus Torvalds, something like that. He's going to get mad at me if I don't pronounce it right. Yeah. But actually, I hear in America he pronounces it Linus, so that way it's easier that way for all of us Yanks. Yeah, so we've got Linus Torvalds has agreed to a brief interview, and we'll have him on shortly, but I just want to check in with you. How's the book going, Jono?
Book's going well, actually. I'm really, really, really happy about it. For those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, it's called The Art of Community. It's published by O'Reilly. A couple of days back, I released it under the Creative Commons license as well. So people can share it, they can redistribute it, they can give it to their friends. You just can't sell it, because if you want to sell it, you know, you should really go and buy a copy from O'Reilly, you know, the people that published it. So, yeah, it's doing well, and it's got good reviews on Amazon, which makes me happy. So...
very cool.
Very happy. Very happy.
And you were at our Linux Fund party last night.
Yes, indeed.
You got to help us give away, was it 12 copies, 10 copies, some number of copies?
Well, originally it seemed like there was about 8 or 10 copies, and then a whole load more copies came out from underneath the table, which I had no idea about. I thought it was really nice what the Linux Fund did. They basically spoke to O'Reilly and got a bunch of copies of the book and then gave them to people who've been leading communities. And you know, I got to meet everyone and sign the books, and I was asking, just had a bit of a chat to see what kind of communities the people running Smalltalk and Perl communities and Lugs and people doing social change groups. And it was really remarkable to meet this great group of people who probably don't really need to read the book because they're really doing it. So
is that the closest you've gotten to an actual book signing for this yet?
This is the first event that I've been to since it's been released. So, with the exception of signing some books for our friends the other night.
Yes.
But they don't really count.
How did that feel with your first book signing?
Oh, I've signed books before. This is my fourth book, so I've signed books before. Okay. But it always feels weird because it's a computer book. I mean, it's not like I'm Dan Brown or something. I mean, it's, you know, let's be honest.
I do know the feeling, though, having done a few of my own books.
Well, you have a vaguely popular book.
A few, actually. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so.
That's good. It's very good.
But it's fun. How do you feel when you've done it before?
It's a little odd because, again, I think of fellow computer geeks as just, you know, just geeks like me, but... and I don't know why they would want me to sign something then. It's sort of like...
defacing it.
I don't, you know, I'm not sure... yeah, they, really. That's what I always tell them. Look, this makes it a used book. You're not going to get as much resale value out of it. But apparently, they still want me to put my John Henry on it somewhere. So, do you have any little cute phrases when you're signing it?
Well, I wrote something for everybody. I think it's nice. You know, I was just writing like, you know, it depended on what they were talking about. But you know, thanks for keeping up a good job and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. Some of them, like, so for some people I know, it was like a bit more personal. Like a friend of mine called Ricky. She works on Linux Pro Magazine. Mm-hmm. I just wrote "I love you" 3 times in the book because she was like, "I want you to tell me that you love me" in the book. So I like drew hearts all over it. It was quite ridiculous.
Did you literally write "I wrote you" 3 times or "I love you" 3 times?
No.
"I love you" 3 times.
I should have written that.
"I love and you" then, 3 long times.
And, yes, and Jeremy from Linux Questions, who's a friend of ours, yeah, who did one of the review quotes at the beginning. I also crossed his name out, so it became a bit more personal as well. So it was fun.
I also try to write, if I know the person, I try to write something else. But I have a fallback phrase. But now everybody who's gotten this will know that it's a fallback phrase, but I don't care. It's a good thing. I invented this many years ago when I first started signing the first Camel book. It's to whoever without whom this note would make no sense.
Ah, that's good.
It's a nice fallback.
It's amazing when you get to the point where you need a fallback phrase. Yes. I'm not at that point, so
okay.
It's still a novelty to me.
Well, Jono, it's good to see you in person. I mean, it's rare that you come.
You're much shorter in real life.
Hey, we've seen each other in person before.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. So. You're much further away in real life.
This big.
It's all perspective. Well, without further ado, let's bring our very, very special guest on today.
Okay, so on today's show, we've got the arguably the founder of the open source free software, whatever you want to call it, revolution, Linus Torvalds, who has repeatedly stated that he hates conferences. So why the hell are you at LinuxCon, Linus?
It's local, so I can't avoid it. And it's not that I hate conferences. I just don't particularly enjoy them. I'd much rather just be in my basement reading email.
So you're based in Portland, and you moved to the US from Finland, right? And the project all kicked off in Finland. So give us the start of the story, how this crazy life that you've inherited kind of kicked off.
I don't know. That's where do you want me to start?
So your parents met, then what happened after that?
I'm not going into those kinds of details. It actually started at University of Helsinki, where I wanted to, or I learned about Unix. And the university had been using VAXes and VMS before that. And that had been my introduction to large machines and series operating systems. And I had been completely underwhelmed by that. And then they started this Unix course, and the world changed. Suddenly I saw what the point of an operating system was. It wasn't just the program loader like DOS, and it wasn't this horrible, incomprehensible, and stupid system like VMS. It actually had a point to it. Unix had a philosophy, and it actually made programming easier by helping you debug things and having all these interfaces that made sense. And so I wanted that at home too, and I couldn't get it. And to make a long story short, I just wrote it myself. Yeah.
And you were playing with the Ultrix at the time, wasn't it?
So I think the university machines ran Ultrix on VAXes, but hey, it's a long time ago. Maybe I'm wrong. What would the Unix be that you would run on a micro VAX?
That would be
Ultrix, yeah.
Ultrix, which has its own faults.
Ultrix was definitely not my optimal Unix. It was what I was introduced to, and then very quickly afterwards, the university started using Solaris, or at that point, Sun OS 4.1. I think it was 4.1. Way superior to both Ultrix and Solaris, and that ended up being what I tried to really make Linux look like. So I used I used to have the policy that everything, this was early 90s, so all the open source projects and pretty much everything was built for Solaris by default because it was, or SunOS, because that was the most common environment, especially inside universities. And I wanted to make my system look as much as like that as possible, so that everything would just build for Linux.
Now you did the Linux kernel as your master's thesis?
Yes and no, not really. So the kernel itself was always my private project, and it was had very little to do with my studies, except in the sense that it delayed them. And then for the longest time, I had everything done at university except for my master's thesis, and they accepted the notion that I could talk about Linux for the thesis, and I wrote the thesis about portable memory management as done by Linux. So Linux itself was never a project that had anything to do with my studies, but I was able to use a small part of it for my thesis.
So you published this out on the net. There's some initial interest, or was it overwhelming to begin with?
No, it was actually overwhelming pretty quickly. But overwhelming for me at that point was like 100 people were actually using it. Mm-hmm. And that happened within a few months. It wasn't immediate, but it was almost overnight that it went from I had been in contact with 5-10 people who had shown interest in operating systems and that I talked to about this project to having actual users, and that went from, I mean, August 91 to January 92, so a couple of months, and I suddenly had this overwhelming feel that, hey, where the hell did this project go? I mean, this is not meant to happen.
Now, Ultrix wasn't open source at the time. What gave you the inspiration to make your kernel open source?
To a large degree, it was actually the compiler. So GCC was a huge reason for Linux wasn't actually under the GPL initially. It was my own license that was 5 sentences. Linux public license, yeah. And it basically said no money at all can change hands, because that had been my main irritation when I tried to get Unix on my machine was I could not afford Unix on my machine. So one of my original issues had been the no money clause. Mm-hmm. And then largely because I recognized GCC, I ended up deciding, hey, the money wasn't the important part, just as long as I get source back and it's freely available to everybody. And so that's how the GPL then happened.
Now, good thing that you got rid of the no money clause, or a huge industry would not have arisen from that.
Yeah, well, I mean, initially it was not even for the huge industry. It was for the really small industry. I got, I forget exactly when, but it was around Christmas in 91 that people actually started saying that they went to Unix user groups meetings and they wanted to give floppies out to people with, I mean, Linux at that point fit on a single floppy, right?
Nothing fits on a floppy anymore.
No. In fact, maybe it didn't really fit on a single floppy. In a single floppy, you could get a shell up and running, but if you wanted something more, it was a couple of floppies, yes, right? So they said, I want to really copy this and give it out at my local Unix users group meeting, but I don't want to lose money on just the floppies. I'm okay with doing it without actually making any profit, but I want them to pay at least for the cost of floppies themselves. Mm-hmm. And that was obviously reasonable. There was no possible reason for a license to say, no, you can't do that. And at that point, when you actually start thinking about, okay, so what about this whole no money clause? You can't really put a limit. Sure, I could have made it not for profit or something, but then you get into the whole gray area where is your time worth anything? Of course it's worth something, right? So I just decided that no, money wasn't really the whole point.
So the GPL was initially attractive because you were using Bash, was it?
I was using Bash and I was using GCC, and those were actually the two main projects at that point that I was really aware of as GPL programs. I also had a friend who ended up sharing a room as teaching assistants at the university, who was very much into the whole free software thing. So he dragged me to one of the... Yes, that's Lars. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, no, and so he dragged me to this Richard Stallman talk in... I think it was at the Helsinki University of Technology in Espoo. So I had actually seen RMS give a talk, and so I was aware of the whole free software thing, and I agreed with the license at the time.
So you know, with I know one thing that everyone here is familiar with is when you create a new project, you scratch your own itch, you start hacking and you're enjoying hacking, and then it becomes a real project where you need to maintain it and you need to have a level of stability. That happened very quickly with Linux. How did you feel when it became real? Like, did you feel at one point like less attracted to the project because it was now a real project and you weren't just hacking?
No, it actually completely the opposite of that. I had had this history of doing all my own projects. I'd basically never bought any software at all. So I'd done my own games and they sucked. And I've done my own assembler and it sucked. And I've done my own editors and that was kind of cool.
You had a clone of Pac-Man, was it?
That was one of the games I'd done. Yeah, I mean, they were not exciting projects. And part of them not being exciting projects was that I was always more interested in the programming than in the end result. So what ended up happening with Linux was, rather than being another of those failed projects where, okay, I've done this now, let's find the next failed project to program on, when people actually started using it, that meant that, hey, I actually have users. So now I had the motivation and the excuse to continue what I wanted to do, which was the programming. I was never all that interested in the end result. The end result was kind of secondary.
Right.
So becoming a real project was actually, to me, it was great because suddenly all those finishing touches and the details that you have to get right because it's actually a serious project, now I had the motivation to do them, which I hadn't had before.
But in the early days, Linux wasn't obviously your primary source of income. What was your day job through there that kind of helped support your nighttime activities with Linux?
Well, I mean, in the really early days, I was literally a student in Finland. And this whole university student thing works differently in Finland than it does in the U.S. In the U.S., you pay 40 grand per semester for a good university. And you live on campus and you hopefully have either really rich parents or you have a summer job and you take a huge loan. In Finland, the university fees per year are, at least at the time, and I don't think they've changed, were about $50. And that was actually not technically for university. That was for the extended healthcare that they make sure that university students get, probably because of liver problems due to excessive drinking or whatever. I mean, so to cover that extended healthcare, you had to pay $50 a year as a university student. Plus, then you get subsidized student loans. So for the first few years, I mean, I was just playing around at the university and doing Linux and partying and being, well, not a lot of partying. I was a geek, right? Yeah. So that the whole making money was not an issue. And then later on, I started making a name for myself. So I was a TA at the university, and that actually paid my way that way.
And then you went in the army for a while?
Well, that was actually before. Yeah. No, everybody goes to, well, used to go to the army in Finland. But that was before I even started Linux.
That's interesting. You're in the army. You don't seem, no offense, but you don't seem much of a military man. How did you cope with that particular experience in your life? Let's step away from Colonel for a moment. How did you deal with the cold showers and the pain and misery of being in the army?
So, one nice thing about conscription is that everybody has to do it, right? So it's part of the culture. And it means, A, forevermore, you can meet any Finnish male person and you can sit down over a beer and you have nothing else in common, but you can complain about how horrible it was to be in the army, right? Because we've all gone through it. So it's not like you're there with a lot of people who are excited about the army. You're there with a lot of people who are equally bummed, right? It's one of those things you just have to do. And it wasn't that bad. One of the things it results in is this whole U.S. idolization of the armed forces. It just doesn't exist in Finland. It's like, I've been there. I know what it's like. They're not that smart. It's not that glamorous. It's not worth it, right?
Yeah, in England, it's like being in the army, from what I've heard, is like just one extended physical education session at school. You know, it's kind of...
Yeah, I was definitely in the best shape of my life, which is not saying a lot. But, I mean, after I came out of the army, I was in better shape than I have ever been since then.
So since this whole roller coaster's kicked off and Linux is, you know, it's something that when I'm on a train and I, you know, the inevitable question of what do you do comes up. Have you heard of Linux? A lot of people really have heard of Linux now. So since it's become like this big thing, how have you found, have you dealt with the fame and kind of the success of the project and the fact that people want to talk to you at conferences and do really irritating radio shows like
yes.
this?
Yes. It's not noticeable during normal life. It really isn't. Because I don't like conferences that much, I go to a couple of conferences a year. And the ones I go to tend to be pretty low-key anyway. And the Kernel Summit is just other kernel geeks, so people don't really even want to talk to me. They just want to throw darts at me, right? None of this is normal.
And you were at Transmedia for a while.
Yeah,
and,
7 years.
For 7 years, yeah. And now you're funded by the Linux Foundation. How did that start?
So I never wanted to work for a Linux company. I mean, it was always, not always, but it quite clearly became an option around late 90s when, I mean, the big Linux companies started happening, and especially when the IPOs happened. It was very clear that, hey, I could work for one of those guys, right? And I didn't want to do that because... To me, being independent and being seen as obviously independent was pretty important. Yeah. So I felt like I could never work for somebody like a Red Hat. At the same time, Transmeta had been very successful, but then I was making ready for whichever kernel release it would have been 6 years ago. I forget. I mean, it's somebody should look up the history. But I was basically saying, I told my boss at Transmeta that I need to take a year off because I need to concentrate 100% on Linux. And Transmeta had been really good. I mean, they'd let me do Linux when I needed to. And they actually said, hey, it's okay. You can take a few months off and do just Linux. Don't worry about it.
What was the rest of your day job there?
I was actually doing, Transmeta was doing an x86 clone in software. The actual hardware had assist features for doing x86 emulation, but the software was doing the heavy lifting. And there are surprisingly few people who really know how an x86 works. I mean, everybody knows the basic instruction set, but when you come to how segmentation really works, there aren't that many people who know all of that. And I know how that works. I have lots of experience with all the small details. So I was involved with, I did the first interpreter inside Transmeta for actually doing instructions. They had started off with this notion of translating everything without even interpreting instructions individually at all at first. And I changed that. And as I'd been involved, but then at the end of that thing, I was more and more disengaging just because I was spending so much time on Linux, and I was feeling this was what was really important for me. Yeah. And they would have allowed it, which was, I mean, ludicrous. And I felt really bad. Well, not really bad, because, hey, how bad can you feel about somebody wanting...
How bad is it going to be when you get... You're basically a dream job, right?
Yeah. So I still felt a bit guilty about this. So I said, no, I'd rather take a year unpaid leave. And then... OSDL, who's now Linux Foundation, came in and said, hey, you don't actually have to be unpaid. And what really convinced me was the whole, I really don't want to go through the paperwork with health insurance and stuff like that. So I'll try this for a year. And now it's 6 years later, and I'm still in the same situation. And what had changed was Linux Foundation, or OSDL at the time, was clearly neutral. I mean, everybody hated them. Well, not everybody, but I mean, they were not seen as a competitor, even when people didn't necessarily trust them. And I think Linux Foundation now is actually, they made their name.
What was the transition like from Finland to California?
It's hard to tell because so much else really changed. Our oldest kid, who's now 12, She was 10 weeks when we moved. So I had my first real job. I mean, being a TA is not, I mean, at university, it's not a real job. Let's face it, right? And I had a kid who was 10 weeks old, moved to a new country, had to, I mean, I didn't speak English. I was fluently reading and writing English because that's what I'd been doing for several years, but I've never actually spoken it. So, I mean, the first few, I mean, it was just a huge shock. I remember having had horrible headaches for the first 2 weeks just from having to concentrate on understanding what people were saying to me, right? So it was a big change.
So the transition from California to Oregon wasn't quite as shocking.
No, the transition to Oregon was very easy.
It also seems a little overgenerous referring to it as English on this side of the U.S. I mean, it's English kind of infused with a lot of likes and...
Yeah, we're talking
totally.
We're talking Northern California here. Now, yeah. if anything, what I found funny later on when I had moved to the Bay Area was how that happened. There.
Greatest ringtone ever at the back of the room. Yeah.
What I found funny later on was I had an ex university buddy who came and visited me in California.
Yeah,
and. He couldn't understand half the people he met because they all had Indian accents or other Asian accents. And I noticed I had no trouble at all understanding them, but because I'd gotten very used to that.
You sort of absorbed all of that at once.
Yes.
So this was English for you.
This was English, the whole odd situation. And I'm really happy that it sometimes happens that people say that I don't have any accent at all. So I,
your accent now is a lot less than what, 5 years ago when I first met you?
Well, I'd hope so.
Yes. So it's definitely.
But it's not one of those cases where 12 or 13 years later, people can still tell that, okay, very strong accent. I'm happy.
Did you find it? So I've been living in the U.S. just over a year now, and the English are a very cynical group of people. The Finns are. Fairly cynical as well, to a degree. Did you find that, you know, Californians traditionally are not quite so cynical? I found that quite difficult to deal with at first, you know.
No, that
getting
was,
my dose of cynicism. You
that
know,
was lovely,
that?
As you
I
would
missed
say.
That.
No, it was, I mean, we reacted many times early on with how friendly people were. And yes, they were friendly in a shallow kind of way where you'd stand in line. I remember my wife was standing in line at the bank or something like that. She was talking to the woman who had a baby who it turns out was born on the exact same day as our oldest kid. And they became friends and we were good friends with them in California. And we were talking to each other how something like that would never happen in Finland because in Finland, people don't speak to each other.
Yes.
You take public transportation and you may sit right next to somebody, but if he starts talking to you, there's something wrong with him. Just move away slowly because
so you might have transitioned to New York first before coming to California. It would have been less of a shock.
Maybe be a map,
but
right there,
where can you go to find the most finicky people? Yeah.
But it was actually enjoyable to have. Yeah. Okay, who cares if it's shallow or not? It's a friendly shallow instead of
people.
So do you find Oregonians to be that shallow too, or is there a dial in some direction for that?
Careful,
I live here.
What I don't know if this is true or not, but I think that you get shallower the further south you go along the coast.
I'd agree. All my California friends are going to write me now, but that's okay. So I understand you're approaching 40, and I'm wondering if you have anything special planned for that.
Well, clearly you know I have something special planned for that since you wouldn't ask otherwise. What?
And now, that would be?
No, I'm going away diving for another week this year. Normally I only spend 1 week diving a year. This year
cool.
I speak,
you
spend
favorite
two.
Favorite area for diving?
It's not so much a favorite as a normal area as Hawaii. It's just very easy to get to. The diving is not spectacular, but it's very easy and it's very convenient.
Cool.
But this year we're trying with Belize, where the driving is supposed to be really
Belize.
Spectacular. Mm-hmm. But we've not been
we went
there
on our honeymoon to Belize.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
And you liked it.
Yeah, absolutely wonderful, yeah.
A couple of days ago, during one of the panels, you mentioned the words kernel and bloat in the same sentence.
Yes.
And the Slashdot crowd, the blogosphere, has gone nuts over that. And I was sitting only about 10 feet away from you, and I think in person it didn't seem to have the same spin that most of the blogosphere has quoted and misquoted it as. Could you care to explain what your comment was?
I mean, yeah. I actually would rather talk about this whole Slashdot thing instead of the bloat thing, because I mean,
we can talk about both.
The real problem is that whatever it is, you always Slashdot tends to get hung up on one word, and then they lose everything else, and it's very sad. I've seen that several times, not just when it comes to technology. It's like there's this visceral reaction to a very small part, and then everybody just looks at what other people quoted and they forget what the actual original issue was.
I think if you actually read the article that a Slashdot article is about, you actually are forbidden from commenting.
Yeah, it's almost like that.
You're supposed to read the summary and then other people's comments and comment on
that. Yes, absolutely.
No, if you read, I just feel dirty when I start typing in a comment. I think, no, this is wrong. I'm going to have a shower first. Yeah.
So I actually enjoy reading Slashdot occasionally just because, not because the stories are important, but because it's interesting to see the crazy, right? It just pours out. And it's kind of like primetime TV, or even more like a soap opera on the internet.
Open source is Big Brother, right?
But yeah, when it comes to the actual bloat thing, I mean, it's unquestionable that Linux is huge and we're spending way too many cycles on a lot of things that we should be able to get faster. I get irritated every time I look at the security subsystem and the auditing, because every single system call, instead of just doing what the system call is supposed to do, like open a file or something like that, it's spending several nanoseconds just thinking about it and whether it should audit this file and whether it should be logged because there are security issues and things like that. And all of it, which has no actual, they don't benefit the user. Well, hopefully the auditing does benefit at some point, but it's not a direct benefit to what the program asked the kernel to do.
Right.
And I get discouraged by that, and at the same time I realize we have to do it. So the kernel is pretty damn large and pretty damn bloated, and I look at some of our iCache counters, and it's sometimes a bit sad, because that's not what it used to be like 15 years ago. I was very proud of the fact that we spent the minimum amount of energy required, basically, on doing what the user asked us to do. And now the kernel has all these infrastructure for
doing things. Is part of that inevitable because you have so many different developers contributing their own independent pieces to the kernel?
There's bloat in that sense that the kernel is just large, but that usually doesn't really bother anybody. I mean, the fact that we have a million drivers, if you only have a few pieces of hardware, the other drivers will never be seen. The more insidious kind of thing tends to be exactly the thing that gets involved in every decision, and that's when security issues come up. That's why I mentioned logging and auditing. But it's also things like when you need to have a capability, you add in hooks to do certain things. So the networking side in Linux is very capable, and it does all these firewalling things, and the firewalling can be quite involved. In practice, most people don't use all the power we have. But because we have all these hooks, just to even check, do I need to inspect this packet, even though it ends up being over loopback and nobody actually has any security issues over loopback, we have all this code to check whether we need to do something.
So if there's some cheaper way to factor those out once and for all when it's known there's not needed for this particular invocation?
Well, on the other hand, every time you try to do that, the end result tends to be worse. Okay. It's been done. There's been operating systems that basically dynamically generate code on the fly. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful for certain benchmarks, especially. And you can kind of prove that, okay, that particular path is now optimal because I have generated code for that only does what it needs to do. But there are so many downsides, and it adds complexity at a whole other level that now you're screwed anyway. Mm-hmm. So I'm not unhappy with where Linux is in the end, because I think we're doing a good job. But at the same time, it is this constant irritant that it should be possible to be better, but we're not.
Do you know of any other large operating system kernels that do it better?
No. I mean, in the end, what I'm really proud about is in the Git project, I end up seeing what everybody else does, and Linux is light years ahead. Linux may be bloated, but Linux isn't this horrible pig that should have been shot in the head 15 years ago. Right.
Speaking of Git, that's your other one of your other many claims to fame. Tell me how the Git project came about. I actually know the answer to this, but Peter, you can talk about it.
This is another area where I'd like to bring up the pinheads on /dot. What ended up happening is that it's almost 10 years ago now. Wow, it's a long time ago. I started using a source control management system called BitKeeper, BK. And it was absolutely the best one on the market back then, and it's still one of the top ones now, almost 10 years later. And it did things that nobody else did and nobody else even really thought about doing at the time. And it was commercial. And Larry McVoy, who wrote it and did a commercial entity around it, Bitmover, said, hey, I like open source. I really like Linux kernel. If you do open source, you can use it for free. So I'm a pragmatic engineer, and I'll use whatever is best. And BitKeeper was the best thing by a long shot. I mean, it was not a close race. It was very obvious. But not everybody was happy about this, right? And not everybody signed on, and there were various flame wars. There were many things that went wrong. The thing that eventually made it impossible to continue to use BitKeeper was a detail that was maybe not even that important, but it was personally very irritating to me how people can't get along just because they have these fundamental religious differences. And so I had to stop using BitKeeper, which was a wonderful project, and I thought it was really cool. And I had to stop doing kernel development, because during the 5 or 6 years the kernel had been using BitKeeper, the open source projects to do source control management had gone absolutely nowhere. So it was 5 years later, and I decided, okay, everybody else is getting it wrong, so I can do better in 2 weeks. And as usual, I was right. So 2 weeks later, I had Git, and I started doing kernel development again. And nobody else could actually use my project because it was not very user-friendly. And that has taken, 5 years to get to the point where people are realizing that Git is actually easier to use than anything else. But it part of that is Git has gotten way, way easier to use. Part of it has been that the mindset, it took people a long time to wrap their tiny, tiny brains around doing things different. Okay, I'm now the most popular person on Earth again after having tried to really let my charm show through.
Are you surprised by the success of things like GitHub?
Not actually. Git has not surprised me as much as Linux did. I mean, Git, I'm very happy about the fact that a lot of projects seem to have gotten the whole point of doing distributed source control management. But I was convinced it was the only sane way of doing it, I mean, when I started. So I'm not surprised that eventually people figured it out. So the success of Git in that sense has not been a huge surprise. It's been pleasant. What's been really pleasant is Junio, the Git maintainer, who's been maintaining Git for 3-4 years now, has been such a, I mean, I I've been so happy with being able to leave all the day-to-day maintenance to him, and get, to me, it's not the kind of project like the kernel is, where I have to spend all my time just following it.
Is that your day-to-day activity then, is mostly just watching the kernel mailing list and trying patches out?
I don't watch the kernel mailing list because nobody can really watch that thing. It's a flood of yes, it is a beast. But yeah, what I do is I read email, and I read the kernel mailing list only when I get suckered into one of the threads, and then I try to read by being CC'd on that particular thread, or when people point me at a particular thing that, hey, you should comment on this, or you should be aware of this issue that people are talking about. But yeah, so that's what I do. I do.
So you know with if you look at the evolution of a lot of software projects, you know, a group of people work together on something, and kind of deciding what you want to do is a case of often throwing something at the wall and seeing if it sticks. And then when it becomes a big project, like with companies, the development process gets a bit more formal. There's requirements gathering, and there's project plans and strategy and all that kind of stuff. It seems like there's many, many cooks in the kitchen with Linux, and there doesn't seem, from what I've seen, to be necessarily a huge amount of formality in terms of that kind of approach. Is it still just kind of throwing at the wall and seeing if it sticks, or is it more formalized than we realize?
It's not actually very formalized, but a lot of the rules are very much implied in how we do things. And it's one of the reasons it's sometimes hard to get into kernel development. One reason is just a purely technical one, that the kernel is, whatever, 12 million lines of code. Don't quote me on that. I haven't counted it lately. But, I mean, it's a lot of code, and a lot of it is complex code. But the other reason is, in order to get into the kernel development, you don't just have to know the code you're going to change. You have to know it's a whole culture. And some of it is the Unix culture, which on a purely technical level of how things are done, but a lot of it is the whole culture of how you interact with people. Some of it is purely technical, the whole sign-off thing and how to use Git and how to send patches the right way. Yeah. But a lot of it is also just learning to how you deal with people. And some people get that wrong, and then they get very upset when their code is not accepted, because in the end, code quality is of paramount importance. But in the long run, it's not enough to have great code. You also have to show that you can work with other people. And almost none of that is really formalized. We have formalized some things. There are documentation about, like, the details, but other parts you really have to learn.
I guess the benefit of that is that it's kind of self-moderating as well. Because I'm assuming what you don't want is, you don't want drive-by contributors. You want someone who's going to maintain their contribution. Someone who, you know, has written 10 lines of Python, decide they're going to try and learn C, and get that trophy patch into the kernel.
Yeah, no,
I'm assuming that you kind of want to stay away.
We actually encourage people, if you send a simple patch that is obviously correct, and if you want just the trophy patch, getting there is very easy, because people, we try to make it easy to have these drive-by simple patches, just because that's also how people do end up getting involved. Yep. But yeah, it is complicated. The good news is a lot of it is fairly, I think, fairly much how people work in general. It's not, we haven't built up this complicated culture that is odd. Yeah. The culture has kind of built itself.
Mirrored itself,
yes.
Right.
And it's come out of just how people work. And so, for example, I work with 10 to 15 main maintainers, sub-maintainers. They tend to work with other people. And I think the 10 to 15 is not at all a random number. I happen to think it's people are good at working with a handful of people, a few handfuls of people.
It kind of mirrors typical development teams. Yeah. Like, you have a set of engineering managers, and then they have their own team.
Yeah.
And it flows naturally up.
And it's not that hierarchical. It's not as, in a company, you'd have a pretty strict hierarchy. Mm-hmm. In Linux, you don't tend to have that. It's pretty common, actually, to have one person who's on two teams, and there's no fight over who manages him, right? There's no, because you don't have this notion that it has to be hierarchical. It's more of a network of things, and that just means that he knows two different maintainers, and he works on two different parts, and there's no schizophrenia involved, yeah. Right?
So how does this intersect with the distros? I mean, do you find that some of the distributions who are doing some upstream development, you know, is there much of a, will they just often code dump, you know, drop big gobs of code, and then you've got to kind of deal with that huge patch that you've got to merge?
It doesn't happen anymore. We used to have issues with distros that had, they had their own distro patches, and those patches were huge. And sometimes they tried, at least the clueless distributions, tried to kind of push through some big piece that they used and they needed and kind of bypass the community.
Right.
And it never worked. And the distributions that learned are still around. The distributions that didn't learn failed, right? And so the distributions, for example, a lot of people end up, a lot of the developers end up working for one of the distributions or other. I mean, I think when Greg does his numbers of kernel developers, I think Red Hat is number 2 and Novell is like number 3 or something or 4, whatever. So there's most of the developers end up being fairly close to one distribution or the other. But at the same time, they are kernel developers first and distro people second. And I trust them as them and not as the Red Hat representative or the Novell representative. So the trust goes to the person, not to the company.
Do you find that most kernel hackers are kind of like that? Do you find that they are kernel hackers first and there's not many kind of career programmers who are just working on the kernel?
I think that's true in general. And I suspect if you are a good programmer, the only way to become a good programmer is to care about the code. And if you're kind of doing it for your career, you're not going to be a great programmer anyway. Yeah. So,
absolutely. So, moving on a little bit. People are always fascinated with what you're using, what you're running, what your opinions are, right? And I've heard you about your opinions about KDE and GNOME.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff. So
pick something new to flame about.
I'm curious. What distro are you running? What desktop are you running? What are the nuts and bolts of what you do on your system?
People like
to associate with that. You know, when they hear.
I don't have anything really odd going on my system. I mean, I used to say that I was happy with Linux, pretty much by the end of 91, because it already had everything I wanted. That's not quite true, because we got X running and X terms running like half a year later. But I'm still, like, what I'm doing is very Spartan. I have a mail client running in text mode in an X window, right? X term.
You're running Mutt?
No, I'm using Alpine, which is the modern version of Pine by...
Gotcha.
University of Washington. Right. I don't know where it's coming out of, but
we've heard from past guests that you run Fedora. Is that true?
I do run Fedora at the time. Right now, it's changed over time. It's been what I want to do is I want to avoid having to worry about the distribution. Yeah. So when I start running one distribution on one machine, I automatically start doing it on every other machine, because the last thing I want to have is confusion about, okay, this machine is slightly different from that, because I don't care. The only thing I care about is the kernel, and I'll upgrade my own kernel. So the distro is irrelevant for the kernel, but everything else needs to be the same.
And you got to ask this question for every developer, Emacs or Vi?
Neither.
Neither? Rid of environment?
Good.
I'm using this small editor called Micro Emacs, which, despite the name, has absolutely nothing to do with GNU Emacs, and even the key bindings are not the same, although they're similar. So I'm, I don't know why, but it's also the reason I think why I use Alpine, because Pine, the old Pine email editor was actually based on Micro Emacs. So Micro Emacs got into the email handling indirectly. So I'm used to I can't change my fingers anymore. They know what the commands are. Yes.
I think everyone's guilty of that.
But yeah, my environment is very simple. I don't much care what I run, because it's going to be a compiler make, a web browser to waste my time. And and a few text windows.
One very, very quick final question. There was this whole fake Linus Torvalds thing that was going on. I was one of them. I was lying through my back teeth to try and pretend to be you, along with Matt AC and Joe Brockmeyer. And how did this, how do you feel about this? Did you enjoy reading it?
Well, the thing is, I don't actually follow Twitter. I'm like, I'm a complete...
I'm shocked and surprised.
Yes, yeah. So I'm one of those things. I don't do Facebook. I don't do any of that crap. I'm still doing that old-fashioned email thing, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't really follow any of it. Yeah. Linux Foundation obviously asked me beforehand. I thought it was fine. They asked me if I wanted to be one of the fake Linuses.
That'd be great.
No, it would not. I mean, I thought about it for about 5 seconds and decided it's a lose-lose situation. Yeah. If I actually win the fake Linus contest, that would be horrible, right? That
horrible
everybody would be disappointed with that. And if I lose it, then I'd either be a really bad Linus or I'd have to try to lose on purpose, which, I mean, would also have been horrible. So I decided now.
Your thoughts down to 140 characters couldn't have been that easy.
Yeah, plus now I need to learn how Twitter works.
Just keep
right?
focused on the code.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I was like,
good idea.
It's fine. Go wild. Do your best, but I'm not going to be a fake Linus.
If LinuxCon is here in Portland next year, are you going to come again?
Maybe I need to move away.
Move to Belize. Yeah. There's not a lot of local conferences going on there.
As long as the network's good there. I do want to thank you. You stopped by our Linux Fund party last night and played some pool. Did you win?
All but one game.
All but one.
Yeah, I did suck mostly. But I blame the table and the cue. And the balls were not exactly round either.
And all that noise.
Yeah, the noise was distracting.
I do want to thank you for dropping by last night. That was a real treat for all of us. So really appreciate that. And we've just ran out of time here, but any last words that you want to share with our audience?
No, I don't ever have any last words just because I don't have a message for people. I don't care enough. You can all rot in hell. I'm doing it for my own reasons.
Slashdot tomorrow. Yes. You can all rot in hell.
Pretty well.
Thank you very much for stopping by. I really appreciate that. Thanks. Wow, what an interview. What a privilege to meet and chat with Linus again. I mean, I've been on a couple of cruises with him
Just a honeymoon sort of that?
No. Just the Linux cruises.
For
cruises back in the day when we were doing geeky things as well as Scientific American, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But he's really...
It's fascinating, yeah.
He's humble and opinionated at the same time.
It's a great combination.
I love it. It's incredible. It's like, you know, he talks quietly, but when he... has something to say, he just says it.
Yeah.
It's very nice.
One of the things I like about him is that, you know, people are usually quite opinionated, have got huge asshole potential, right? And you just don't pick up on a jot of that with him. You know, he's just a guy who loves doing what he's doing. And so long as people don't step into his world and screw with that, he's quite happy to let people go out and do what they're doing. So I like that. He's very humble and, you know, I'm pleased that we could, you know, talk about some other stuff, not just talking about kernels. You know, we talked about, you know, what it was like for him to move to the US and all that kind of stuff. So.
Slashdot people.
he's got it in for Slashdot, hasn't he?
It does. Well, I mean, just
it's not completely unsurprising.
Right? The same thing you said about the Twitter people. It's all like, they're all just whack. You know, no Facebook, no Twitter for him. I mean, it's really no point in commenting on everything.
Well, right? Slashdot is kind of like the Inquirer of the open source generation, you know, it's the way it works, but...
Definitely. Well, it was just a treat, though. I'm glad we had a chance to actually work this out. So we do have some... I keep setting the bar for Floss Weekly higher and higher with guests. So
yeah, you're doing a good job.
Next week, God. I guess that's all we can do.
Is he available now?
I got him on the schedule, so he must be here. No, actually, who we have next week is mispronounced his name already, Aaron Fulkerson of MindTouch. MindTouch is a MediaWiki clone that's been commercialized and a lot more things to it. Very, very cool. And I understand Leo's going to be downloading MindTouch software while we're on the chat.
Of course, in traditional Leo fashion.
Very good. And then we got Peter Higgins, the Dojo Toolkit, one of the front end softwares there. A lot of JavaScript and stuff to make things cool on the front end. Rob Savoy of Ganache.
Yep.
We got him coming on. Do you know him? Have you met him?
Yeah, I know Rob. He's completely bonkers possible way. He's great.
Because I'm hoping you're going to be there for that week.
I'll be there. Yeah, no, I'll be there. I'll be there for you.
Because I can't be. I'm going to be on site. So.
And Aaron's going to be a great guest as well. I met him for the for the first time about 2 or 3 weeks. Actually, it was at the Linux Fun party.
Yeah, at OSCON.
At OSCON.
He was one of our sponsors.
He's great fun, and we had a really good time hanging out with him and his other half. And I think he's going to be a great guest, really interesting.
And so, on the short list also, we have Bree Pettis, who did MakerBot, the 3D printer.
Oh, yeah.
It's a 3D printer. That'll be cool.
Is that a 3D printer or a chocolate printer? There seems to be wacky printers going around. Is that the 3D one?
Chocolate printer would be really good. It is the 3D one, yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm told MakerBot is all about that. I'll have to do some research before that show, but it's still coming up. And another show coming up that you helped arrange, Danny O'Brien and Jim Killock. Do you want to talk about who they are?
So Danny O'Brien, they used to be this old kind of, like, what's the best way of describing it? It's like an e-zine, I guess, called NTK, Need to Know. And it was just like this little mailer that went out with really interesting links to stuff. Kind of like Boing Boing in a way. Danny O'Brien was behind it with this other dude. I can't remember his name. And Danny's great. He's great fun. So he's coming on the show, and he's involved with the Electronic Frontier Foundation as well.
That's something called the Open Rights Group.
And the Open Rights Group. So the Open Rights Group are basically a UK... It's an interesting story. Basically, the Open Rights Group is like a UK EFF kind of equivalent. And it started out in London at this BBC event. And Danny was there, and he said, what do you think about this? Should we set this thing up? And I said to him, that would be great. And he said, well, why don't we do it, like, if people pay £5 a month, if they pledge to pay £5 a month, we'll do it. And I said to him, well, I'll sign up. I was the first person to sign up.
Wow.
And then I never ended actually paying them for about a year or two later, and I got endless amounts of grief about it, and then finally signed up about 6 weeks before I moved to the US.
Well, apparently
he's... But they're a great bunch. The Open Rights Group do amazing work in England.
He's gotten over that pain, because otherwise he wouldn't agree.
And that's going to be a funny show. He's a big ball of comedy. So.
Looking forward to that. So you can follow me on Twitter, although you can't follow Linus on Twitter, but you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, and John O'Bacon is John O'Bacon on Twitter.
Yep, that's the one.
Very good.
Well, good.
If you want to see the rest of our upcoming guests or see who we're also sort of trying to schedule in the future, go to twitch.tv/floss, and we have the whole link there. And we also have all the past shows there, all 86 shows now. So
you've been a busy boy.
Back catalog.
Yeah.
All the wonderful people that we've had on the show in the past. In fact, John O'Bacon, you've been a guest, I think, twice, right?
So yeah.
Amazing.
Well, yeah. And thanks again for letting me come on to your masterpiece.
Anytime, John. I'm glad we got a chance to have this interview with Linus today together. They've just been great. So we'll see you all next week on Floss Weekly.